Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Michael Ignatieff, the Carr Professor of Human Rights Policy at Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University, and our topic will be welfare. Michael, glad to have you on the show.
Nice to be here.
What if you could begin by briefly explaining to the listener your rationale for the state's provision of welfare?
Well, I think the first thing is to get some context here. I'm a Canadian, and I've spent a lot of time in England, and in those jurisdictions in Canada and in Britain and in Europe, since the Second World War, I guess, there's been an idea of a right to welfare that's based on the idea of citizenship. That is, if all citizens are going to be equal in a state, then when citizens hit hard times, and the premise here is that hard times aren't their fault, you know, the economy downturns or circumstances in their family, one of their rights of citizenship is to be given a helping hand by the government. Now, European societies sort of believe that. Canadian societies sort of believe that. When I say sort of, it means that they've got some questions about who gets the welfare. That is, should it only be confined to citizens, or should it be extended to other groups like immigrants, people who are passing through and stuff. But the basic rationale for welfare is that it's a right of citizenship, and the right is connected to the idea that you can't have, you know, civil and political rights, you know, the right of free speech, the right of free assembly, all the things that people count on as the basis of their political rights, unless they have some social and economic rights to go with it. That is, you can't be a free man politically unless you're a free man economically and socially. So the idea of welfare is not to kind of eliminate people's freedom, but to give a basis, a floor under which their freedom is then secure.
Okay, could you elaborate a bit on the last point, the degree to which some kind of economic security is essential for personal freedom?
Well, I just think that it's very hard to consider yourself a citizen with equal political rights if you're constantly terrified economically, constantly threatened economically. And the related idea is the thought that you can't feel a connection to the society and a sense of obligations to the society unless you feel the society is also going to give you a helping hand if things turn bad and you can't help yourself. Now, all societies have a problem then about just whether, if you give that helping hand, you remove incentives to work and you remove incentives to self-reliance. And I think all societies have that problem. I have some doubt myself. That is to say, I believe in a right to welfare, but I'm very concerned about not undermining or eroding or destroying incentives to self-reliance and personal responsibility. And all societies deal with it. But I think the important thing is not to take the idea that, you know, if we erode responsibilities and obligations to work, worry about that shouldn't erode or eliminate the whole idea of welfare itself. I think if you go down that road, then you may be looking at a society that looks more like a jungle than a republic of citizens.
Okay. You used the language a couple of times, when citizens hit hard times. And I take it what you have in mind there is that there may be factors about the individual citizen's life at any particular time that may make it difficult for them to make any money, or at least to make enough money to support themselves. Mm-hmm. Perhaps there could be a general downturn in the economy that would make it effectively be a hard time for the individual. The other sort of question, I suppose, which comes to mind, I know a lot of economists talk about that you don't want unemployment to get below a certain level. Perhaps, I mean, they used to say 6%.
Sure.
Now I hear more talk about a 4% level as the mm-hmm. bottom level of unemployment. But that would seem to indicate that the state tries to direct the economy in such a way so that there are always at least 4% of the people unemployed.
Correct. Correct.
And if that's true, there's a sense in which the state itself creates or may create the conditions which lead to bad times for individuals. So all those would be circumstances under which the state should assist the person through those times.
That is basically what's been said in Europe and Canada and many liberal democracies since the 1940s. That is that the economy is not just the economy is the general condition of employment in an economy is very, very heavily affected by government policy. And if, as you say, government policy is setting unemployment rates through the way it manages the economy at 3-4%, whatever, that's another reason why it ought to have some set of obligations towards those who get squeezed by those policies. This touches on very deep philosophical issues about what the economy is. I mean, there are many people who feel the economy is just a collection of separate individuals trying to make a living. And, you know, if they fail or if something goes wrong for them, that's their problem. That's one view of the economy that held by many people, perhaps some listeners of this show. There's another view of the economy that says, actually, the economy is a highly organized structure that is controlled by macroeconomic policy by the government. The government has accepted a responsibility since Roosevelt's times to manage the economy. If it manages the economy, it also has to provide management for the casualties of the economy. And that's another basis for, a basic welfare entitlement.
Given all that, let's go back to one thing you talked about earlier. You said that you share some worries that welfare systems, at least some welfare systems, may destroy incentives to work, may undermine self-reliance, may undermine a sense of personal responsibility. Do you have any sense about what can be done to both meet this idea of a right to welfare without having these detrimental effects?
Well, I think the United States has been through a revolution in this thing, in this issue, since the mid-90s. And I don't want your listeners to think I'm an expert on this subject, but there has been a very, very sharp reduction in simple welfare, pure welfare, and an increasing amount of conditions put on welfare so that people have to go out and seek employment. Essentially, as I understand it in the United States, what's happening now is that in place of welfare, we're getting what could only be regarded as kind of wage subsidy. That is, if you go out into the economy, take a low-paid job, a lot of states now are giving very substantial incentives to employers to take on workers. They're giving assistance to families, so that they can get into the market. It looks like we're eliminating welfare by doing that. In fact, we're not. What we're doing is trying to structure the labor market so that it can suck people into the job market. And those, it seems to me, are good plans. Essentially, they are a way in which states meet their obligations to make sure that people don't go to the wall by improving the incentives to get out into the job market. The concern that everybody has about that is what happens if the economy begins to tank? What happens if the economy goes down? The first people who will be stripped out of the American economy will be that group of people, unmarried women with children, low-skilled people, people with low levels of education, who have been pulled into the economy by these incentives and now will be driven out if the hard times come. And what happens then is, in my view, if the economy can't provide them with work and some measure of dignity, then we are going to have to go back to some form of welfare assistance. So no matter how you cut it, no matter how many ways you walk around this, the fundamental concept, I think, is that a political community, community of citizens, has to look after those who have, trouble or extreme difficulty in supporting themselves. And you can do it with wage subsidies and incentives to employers, or you can do it with straight welfare, but one way or the other, or food stamps or whatever, but one way or the other, that set of obligations that we have to those people has to be met.
And one of the worries in, maybe I'm putting words in your mouth if I am, correct me, but it sounds to me like one of your worries is that the current scheme may seem to hide this obligation of the state to individuals who are in need.
I think that is what I'm saying. And don't get me wrong. I'm you know, if I was a young mother, father had absconded, I had two young children, and I didn't have much skill, it seems to me infinitely better, instead of sitting home watching soaps on TV and drawing a welfare check, you're out there learning some skills in the market, you're improving yourself, you're getting a leg up. I'm entirely in favor of anything that teaches people skills, teaches people to get up to work on time, teaches people to take responsibility for their lives. But they've got to have a helping hand. And a lot of federal programs and state programs do that. I mean, they're not sitting there giving people a soft, easy life. You know, I was just listening to a recent radio documentary from New York about Head Start programs in which, mothers that are in having, trying to do a good job by their children, the kids go into these Head Start programs during the day while the kids are in the Head Start learning certain basic kind of skills as young infants. The mothers are in a class next door learning how to do resumes, getting job training, getting the skills to get their first, get themselves on the first rung of the job ladder. And I just think that's good public policy. I just think that's, that's a very practical way to make sure that we have a society in which everybody, has a stake.
Okay, so that there actually benefits to the society, the whole, by encouraging and helping people to get work, by making them more productive members of society, by making them more self-reliant, all those are going to have benefits for the political system and not just the economic system.
Absolutely. You know, whether we like it or not, we are in one political community. And if you have a large section of the population that is helpless, hopeless, disaffected and alienated, it imposes huge economic, social, and political costs on a society. And that's a prudential reason why I think we need to take some right to public assistance very seriously. And I think there are ways of having a right to public assistance that will not undercut responsibility and taking responsibility for yourself. In other words, I think there's a false dichotomy here between, liberals are so supposed to be soft on welfare, they're supposed to be soft on this issue and that, and conservatives are much tougher. I think, in fact, there's a broad range of agreement across the political spectrum that we want a society of self-reliant citizens who stand on their own two feet. And that value is in common. Then the issue is how to do it, and I'm saying that good, sound, prudent, well-managed public assistance programs at the state and federal level are a way not to reduce self-reliance, but to improve it.
Now, let me ask, I'm wondering if the term, this is going back to something you said earlier, if the term self-reliant, as you're using it, means something at least a little bit different than it might mean coming from a conservative. I mean, you talked earlier about the fact that we're in this together, that we're not just individuals, we're all part of a political structure, we're all part of the economy. The economy's run by the government, or at least directed by the government. So there's a sense in which self-reliance doesn't mean I'm here on my own, wholly separate from everyone else.
Yes, I think that's true. I can't think of self-reliance apart from an institutional structure that sustains me. I mean, I happen to be a teacher in a large institution. I attempt to be self-reliant and responsible and do my job properly and take my moral and political duties seriously. But my possibility of doing that is sustained by the fact that I live in a community, this particular institution. So I don't see, you know, individual self-reliance apart from a kind of community structure that makes it possible for you know, to do that. And I think if you have a very atomistic sense of society, if just it's just a set of individuals strung out like birds on a wire, you know, that's not an image of community that conservatives like any more than liberals like. We both, I think, have a strong, I'm an unapologetic liberal, and if that shocks people to hear me say that, that's fine by me. But I don't think a liberal, you know, wants to undercut the basic idea that, you know, human beings have to stand on their own. They have to make their own choices. They have to take responsibility for their choices. And they have to, you know, they have to pay the consequences of their errors. But I also don't want a pitiless society in which we just let lots of people go to the wall. Life is very, very tough out there. And the wealthiest society on Earth, this one, surely doesn't want to have a society in which people go to the wall in this kind of pitiless way, without help, without assistance, without care, without that help to get your first step on the bottom rung of the ladder.
All right, what I'd like to do in the second half of the show is expand on those themes and look at what you see as some of the limitation or some of the worries you have about welfare, worries that you discuss to some degrees in a book called The Needs of Strangers. But for the benefit of anyone who's tuning in late, this is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Michael Ignatieff, Carr Professor of Human Rights Policy at the Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University, and we're discussing welfare. I wonder, Michael, if you could say a little bit about what you see as some of those limitations of public welfare.
Well, one of them, you know, that occurs to me a lot is that, let me give you an example. You know, when I lived in London in the 1980s, this London, England, there was a bunch of old age pensioners, retired people, who would shop outside my door at a public street market, and there were some old folks who used to come and rummage in a kind of bargain stall, you know, and get old clothes. And I used to watch them, you know, and occasionally I'd give them a hand with their shopping and stuff. And I was very struck by the fact that what was happening is that they were getting their old age pensions from the government, because the government has a old age pension system in England, and they would take that money and they would buy those clothes, and then they go off on their own. And there was a kind of, and I was, you know, I was one of the taxpayers who was paying for those old age pensions, so there was a kind of, there was an actual kind of what you could call a kind of cash nexus between me and those old folks, just sometimes 20 feet from my door, and yet we very rarely spoke. We very rarely had a connection. I think one of the larger kind of philosophical problems about welfare is the sense in which, you know, citizenship, the living, breathing connection we have with fellow citizens is mediated by money, by tax transfers that link citizens but don't actually bring them together. And I sometimes feel that, you know, if you look at another example, you know, we have a neighbor next door, right through the partition wall in the next house, who's sick or ill or something, and instead of going across the door and knocking on the door and say, "Can we bring you some soup?" In some welfare societies, you ring a welfare office and they do it, and so there's no direct connection between you and your citizen next door. And in fact, the welfare system, the public assistance system, cuts between citizens in a way. It kind of expropriates moral concern direct between people. I think one of the things that is fueling the concern in the new Bush administration for, you know, faith-based assistance programs is the idea, you know, that if we get church groups and mosques and synagogues into this story, we can reconnect people to people in a more direct way than the public assistance system does. So that I do have concerns about the ways in which, I don't know, welfare may confiscate moral responsibility on the part of people in jobs towards people out of jobs. There's some weird way in which we use the welfare system to become our kind of alibi for not being concerned. We say, well, you know, someone's looking after them. It's not us, but it's someone. I mean, the state, the bureaucracy, whatever. And it's that problem, I think, that sometimes strikes me. In other words, we have and it's a challenge to liberals like myself. We say, you know, having a tax system that supports public assistance is a way of expressing the solidarity of one citizen to another. Well, the reality is that, in fact, that welfare system may cut across a direct relationship of citizen to citizen, a caring relationship, a concerned relationship, a neighborly relationship. And so I think often this is a challenge to the liberal side of the argument. Liberals have not thought about the ways in which we've kind of, if I can use some jargon, in which we've bureaucratized social solidarity.
All right, well, let me ask you, I can imagine someone defending the current practice saying, well, look, this is just a division of labor. I don't normally participate in the defense of my country, and I don't police the streets. I don't build the roads. I get someone else to do it. That's exactly what it is to be part of society. So that's what I'm doing with welfare, too.
Yeah,
is there something different about welfare that makes this a problem that it's not for other kinds of governmental actions?
Well, I think that's true. Government is in a division of labor, you know, and the division of labor works through everything we do. That is, we are not activist citizens all the time. We elect a congressman or a state representative. We delegate to them the business of public business. Likewise, we delegate to a welfare caseworker or a nurse or a hospital person the burdens of care that a society undertakes in our name. Some of that division of labor is fine and necessary. I'm not advocating that we should all be kind of saints, you know, constantly taking dinners to our sick neighbors, but and concern for our own private business, it seems to me, is entirely legitimate and appropriate. I just think at a certain point you don't want a society where you think everything is in the division of labor. For all social duties, someone else is responsible. I mean, at some point you do want a society where you're forced to ask yourself, well, maybe I should step in here. You know, maybe I should do something. You know, there's someone in need next door. There's something I can do to help. You know, I want to do it. And, you know, there's a great tradition of generosity in American communities and small towns. It's one of the reasons why people are very nostalgic when they live in cities about the generosity of small towns and small communities, because there isn't this division of labor. There's much more kind of direct face-to-face contact, or at least that's what city folks like me nostalgically thinks goes on in these communities. Whether it does go on in these communities is for those communities to tell me. But I think all modern societies have a bad conscience, a kind of guilty conscience about this social division of labor. That is, they know it's necessary, but they think it's kind of, as I say, confiscating the exercise of moral solidarity.
Okay, so some division of labor is unavoidable given the size of our countries. The question is whether we ought to let it completely take over our responsibilities. I mean, it seems to me you might even say the same thing about other ways in which you're a citizen. Yeah, maybe I don't build the roads or defend my country or police the highways. However, what I do or should do as a citizen is at least actively participate in, choosing my public officials, reading about important public issues, letting those officials know what my views are. That's another way in which we might be active without doing everything ourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there is some obligation. You can enforce it. You shouldn't enforce it. The citizens be informed. I think there is some obligation if you're, you know, I think what makes sense is to be concerned at the direct level at which you are impacted by particular services. I mean, if you got kids in school, in primary or secondary school, you want to be concerned with your school district, and you want to be concerned for the best possible reason. You got kids in it, and you're spending money, and you want to make sure that money's well spent. So there's a tremendous amount of activism down at the school district level. People get heavily involved if, you know, with municipal politics, if, you know, there's some zoning decision or some local decision that's going to impact on them directly. I mean, my sense of your involvement is that it's driven, you know, by very, very strong forms of self-interest. It's not just an exercise of kind of detached philanthropy. I mean, you get involved in your school district or your hospital or your police service or your fire service or your municipality because they're delivering something really essential to you, and you're paying for it out of your taxes, and if it's not being done right, you want to get roll up your sleeves and get involved and go to the meeting and shout and stamp your feet and say, you know, the money's being wasted and ought to be spent better. So, you know, the idea that you can kind of just cut yourself out of all this public life is a mistake, because if you do, you're going to neglect protecting some of the most essential interests that you have. I'm trying to break down the difference, the division between, you know, your home is your fortress, and your home is the only area where you're supposed to be concerned. Your immediate family is the only locus of your concern. And just say that, you know, you can't protect your family by building a wall around it. You've got to go out into the public realms, like the schools, like the municipality, like the police service, like all the places which impact on your family, and try and do something small, little, mild, to make sure they're doing their job.
And if we do that, then that would be a way in which we could both fulfill our responsibilities, show our solidarity with others, while also recognizing that at least some of the fulfillment of our obligation to others will be met by the government.
Correct. Exactly.
Okay. We just got about a minute left. Is there any sort of last point you'd like to leave with the listener to think about before we have to disappear from the air?
Oh, I do have a concern about this faith-based approach to charity and public assistance. I mean, I think it's wonderful if church groups get involved in helping others. I think it's terrific. I don't think anybody in their right minds think that's a bad idea. There are a couple of risks. One of them is that faith-based groups only help their own faith and they neglect other people, or they only help people like them. I just think there's no way around the fact that you've got to have some kind of collective, public, state-funded provision of public assistance and welfare in this country. And while I think, you know, faith-based approaches can help and they should be encouraged, they should never be understood as a substitute for this basic kind of state-financed public system.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Pleasure.
I've been speaking today with Michael Ignatieff, Carr Professor of Human Rights Policy at the Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University. This is Hugh LaFollette, Friday's Issues. Good day.